Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, more tax cuts are supposedly being discussed as talks ramp up to make painful cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Yay! Social Security supposedly on the table. And what we've got is a situation where inequality in this country is getting much worse. And yet, all we hear from Donald Trump is just how great things are doing. Because Wall Street's fat and happy. It's wonderful. Stock market through the roof. And yet, as I said, inequality getting worse and worse. And here to share some thoughts on where we are, especially come this election cycle, I've asked Chuck Collins to come talk with us. He's the director of the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Chuck, thanks for taking time for us.
To be with you, Rick.
So, you know, I'm looking at this and, you know, you hear these stories, you know, tax cuts are on the way. They're looking at, you know, more cuts to food stamps and social safety net programs. And it just seems like all of the wrong policies in all of the wrong directions are being pursued at this very moment.
Yeah, no, it's sort of like we're in boom times, but we're going to kind of weaken. And of course, we can question whether there's really a boom for half the population. But it looks like they're dismantling the scaffold, the safety nets that that many people depend on, just to put a election year tax cut out there as another way to rally the vote.
Yeah, I mean, is there a moment in time where we go tax cuts don't work, or let me amend that, tax cuts for the very wealthy don't work?
Well, you know, I think the 2017 Trump tax cut, people overwhelmingly did not fall for it. You know, they heard the trickle-down pitch, and they heard the whistle, and they didn't respond. I mean, overwhelmingly, people polled were just like, this isn't going to be good. This is going to go to the rich. It's not going to help me. So I think that the suspicion that these tax cuts are going to be for working people is finally breaking through. The trickle-down mythology is not – no one's – Fewer people are falling for that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're in this weird moment in this country where there's such wealth, and it's such obscene wealth in the hands of so few, and you still have, you know, children are going to bed hungry, you still have homeless veterans, you still have, you know, all of these societal problems that don't seem to have any answers, and I wonder if our political system is capable of addressing them at this moment.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I feel like the pressure keeps building. You know, if you look at the policies that say Warren, Sanders, you know, raise the minimum wage, tax wealth, eliminate student debt, make the economy work for working people, you know, these are wildly popular proposals. So you sort of have a political class, a captive political system that's keeping these things from happening. And yet from below, the pressure is building. And I actually think things could go, you know, we could see meaningful change if, you know, people start running for office on this, you know, a working people's program, start taking out, and people start losing their seats in Congress because they are standing in the way. We could see a meaningful shift. And on the other hand, things could go badly, as we know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the scary thing, because, you know, the economy is doing okay, and I give Trump the ultimate credit for being just a great pitch man and carnival barker to convincing the rest of a good number of us that the economy is good for everybody. And I don't know if you've seen the latest polling, you know, some more than 60% of the people are saying, you know, the economy's good and I'm better than I was, you know, 3 years ago, and it's because of Donald Trump. And it's just kind of weird to me, because I know so many people who are struggling to get by.
You know, I think that we do, you know, it is great that unemployment is relatively low and that's given workers a little more bargaining power, and so that real wages have, after 40 years of being flat, have started to push up a little bit. But the question is like, John, why did it take so much of the stars to line up just so that workers could share a little bit in the economic boom? And I'm actually looking at a graph that shows what price changes have happened since 1987. So it's great. Incomes, wages are up a little bit. But hospital services, college costs, child care, medical services, everything is higher than the wage growth. Those expenses, housing costs, have all risen way faster than wages. So that's why people can be like, yeah, I'm glad I got a job and my paycheck's got a little more in it, but my expenses are a lot higher on the things I can't trade away. You know, there's some things like TVs and computers and cell phones. Costs have gone down a little bit, have become more affordable, but that doesn't really, the big ticket items are all really much more expensive. And yeah, that's some of the stress we're feeling.
No, I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, we hear a lot of people talk about, when they rate inflation, they throw, all that stuff into the basket when they determine the inflation rate and all that of the computers and all that, because you can buy cheap goods and you go, but everything else is more expensive. Gas is more expensive. Food's more expensive. You know, clothes for the kids, all this stuff down the line. Life has gotten much more expensive, and yet they keep telling us, well, there's no real inflation to speak of.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you, again, look at what do people have to fall back on, savings, reserves, one out of five households has zero or negative wealth. The next fifth has almost nothing in terms of, you have a big bill, you have a car repair, you have a dental bill. You don't have that. It's going on the credit card. It's going on the debt column. And so, even though, again, maybe people feel their wages or their wages have gone up a little, people haven't saved any more money and are actually living closer to the edge than they were a couple decades ago.
Yeah, I throw that out often, and the response I usually get from my conservative listeners is, "Well, that's because they're irresponsible and they don't spend their money right."
Well, fixed costs. Now, I'm talking, housing, healthcare, education, all of those are, double, triple the rate of wages. So it's true, each of us, I myself sometimes put things on my credit card that maybe I shouldn't, but that doesn't obviate the real systematic changes that are happening here. I mean, why is it that home ownership rates have been steadily going down for 12 years? That's not just because people can't save. It's because of all these forms of debt and medical debt being the biggest.
Yeah.
And to the extent that people are going to higher education, that's just stalling out a whole generation of people.
So looking at this coming election in November, I mean, is there someone that you think can make significant changes to this, to where we are and where we're going? Because I talk to a lot of people who seem, to think that there's nothing that can be done. We've got the folks who, what can you do? It is what it is. Do you see someone in this that's possibly a game changer?
Well, I think that the movement around Sanders is game changing. I mean, think about where he is at, I knew him when he was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. 1983, I walked into his office and he said, "Welcome to Burlington." And my job at that point was I was helping him start a nonprofit housing organization to create affordable housing in Burlington. And, 2,500 units later, that organization is one of the most important organizations in the city, created whole generations of new homeowners and affordable rental housing. He's been saying the same things over and over again, and the rest of us have caught up to his understanding about growing inequality, why that's undermining quality of life for working people. I think Senator Warren talks about, reigning in corporations. Changing corporate governance for global corporations. I heard the segment before I was on, where you're talking about corporate power. And, why is it that global companies that operate across state and national borders are chartered in Delaware, where there's like no responsibility, transparency, or accountability? Why we should recharter those companies that are above a certain level, not your neighborhood mom and pop small business, but the big companies, the global transnational companies, should all be subject to a federal charter that has a whole bunch of different rules: transparency, worker representation, community stakeholder representation. Put it all, you know, so we can, you know, people like Senator Warren are saying, let's change some of these systems that are driving the inequalities and the fact that there's really one economy for the super rich and one economy for everyone else.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, I think is long past needed. But for me, as a labor guy, you know, the destruction of organized labor and the attacks that have continued to come year after year, you know, to me, that's the main driving force in a lot of this stuff, in a lot of the growth of inequality. As union density has gone down, inequality has gone up.
Yeah, I mean, if there's, you know, ways we can shift the balance to give workers and workplaces, and even when there's not a union, more workplace power, more say, and public policies that lift up everybody. You know, I grew up the road from you in Detroit, you know, and was around a lot of UAW families. And, you know, in Detroit, the UAW wasn't just a union for its members. It was a organization that lifted up the whole community and lobbied for public policies like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and raising the minimum wage for everybody. So you sort of felt like even if people weren't in a union, they benefited from the fact that there were strong unions in our community.
No, you're absolutely right. I did want to get your thoughts on Mike Bloomberg. I mean, because Bloomberg has, you know, post his mayoral time, you know, he's been this great philanthropist, spending money all over the place, of which I'm not a big fan of billionaire philanthropy. In fact, I think you recently have written a piece on the perils of billionaire philanthropy.
Yeah, no, we're living through a weird time. You know, I call it top-heavy philanthropy because giving by low and middle-income people has been steadily going down over the last two decades. Almost all the growth in charity and philanthropy is from the wealthy and the mega donors and the Mike Bloombergs of the world who have, you know, huge amounts of wealth. Well, that's distorting not only the nonprofit sector and the universities and institutions that depend on charitable money. It means they have to cater to these mega donors. They have to kind of warp their mission and programs to get the funding. And it also is a threat to our democracy because, you know, what is charity? Well, it's taxpayer-subsidized activity.
Yep, and it's so a giant tax dodge.
Yeah, so you and I, for every dollar that a billionaire like Bloomberg gives to charity, you and I chip in anywhere from 40 to 60 cents in lost tax dollars that donor is taking. You know, so whatever their pet cause, okay, I want to build a music studio at my daughter's private rich kid school, you know, and I'm going to give a charitable donation to, you know, that little high school, private high school. The rest of us are essentially subsidizing that gift with lost tax dollars. And I think we'd be better off if we taxed these billionaires and then had a democratic system for allocating the money as opposed to subsidizing their private decision-making and private power.
No, I'm right there with you. And, you know, I look at Bloomberg as, you know, his entrance into the Democratic primary is, for me, all of the wrong things at probably the worst time.
It's really concerning. And, you know, he's done a masterful job spreading his money around to, you know, like, for instance, he's organized mayors around the country around gun violence. So he's funded all these organizations in local communities to address gun violence. Well, that's great. And he's hired these mayors when they retire and they're part of his group. Well, guess what? He's got all these mayors endorsing him. That's not surprising. They've been on the, you know, the charitable dole from his organization, from Bloomberg Philanthropies. And, you know, to his credit, he's a smart donor. He's done good things. He's focusing on, you know, a few problems in a kind of laser-focused way and has made some differences. But it's also then silenced and compromised all these people. You know, think tanks that he funded will not issue critical reports about his policies. So that billion has not only bought him, you know, a slot in a debate tomorrow night and a couple hundred million dollars of TV advertising, it's bought him a constituency, and that's just troubling.
No, and like I said, at the worst time to do this, and for me, as I've been saying, it highlights the fact of how starved the left is for resources that they would be willing to basically sell their souls for what he's peddling.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to his credit, he says he's going to spend $1 billion to defeat Trump, no matter who the nominee, even if it's Sanders or Warren, he's going to spend that $1 billion. But see, even there. It's kind of like, you know, it's like the guy who buys his way into the party, you know. It's a symptom of a very deep malady.
Yep. No, I mean, the corrosive effect of money in our politics is, again, just, you know, one of those things that you can't overstate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And well, hopefully this election, and this is where I keep coming back to, I have hope that at the ballot box, we reclaim our democratic process, and we move forward with a vision on how we make sure that we solve some of these problems. Chuck, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the input, the thoughts, and the great work you guys do over there. Keep it up, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks, and thanks for being the voice for working people that you are. Take care, Rick.
Appreciate it, Chuck. Thanks so much. Chuck Collins. Again, this is, you know, one of those things, as I've been saying, you know, we really need to get... to get our heads straightened. But Chuck's the director of the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. Make sure you check out their work on the website there. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.